First time I heard Lynn on this air, I thought she was Julie Kavner, because she goes on, as we all do here, for hours without saying who she is, because we've all got this complex that, oh, well, I don't matter. I'm just kind of here. And I had been watching Rhoda. This is back in the early 80s, probably about 1980. And I thought it was Julie Kavner. But anyway, Marge Simpson. I thought that she was just your basic suburban Springfield housewife. She drives the station wagon badly. She tolerates and sort of puts up with Bart, who is a real behavior problem, acts out all over the place. She lets Maggie do, she lets Lisa do what Lisa has to do, and sort of keeps Maggie from smashing herself into, but she does anyway. But when I saw a certain episode of The Simpsons, my entire thinking, my entire way of thinking about Marge changed. And this was the episode, I hope you've all seen it, where The Simpsons TV broke and the kids were freaking out, especially Bart. Bart needs his TV like a dying man needs water. So to relieve the, another way of identifying the Simpsons as a true family of the 90s, that when the TV breaks, they freak out. It's like, my God, what do we have to do, talk to each other? Oh, God. So what they did was Homer told the story at Lisa's urging of how he met their mother. And one of the surprising things is that it turns out that Marge is younger than I am. Homer and Marge met in high school. And it was the graduating class of 1974. Now, I graduated high school in 72. So she's 2 years younger than I am, which is a drag. I thought she was much older. But when she was at high school, she was a rabid women's libber. She gave speeches on the campus about how this class was unfair to women and that class was unfair to women and this situation was unfair and all this stuff. And she also was the captain, if not the captain, the star of the debating team. And that takes brains, I'll tell you. I tried it once, and it's, like, very difficult. You can't just stand there and say no. You have to say no and give reasons why it's not true or why you're taking the side that it's not true. And you have to take theoretical sides, and you may believe wholeheartedly in something, and you get picked to argue against it. Very difficult stuff. But it sharpens the mind. It trains the mind. And I don't believe it gets done anymore. I think that went out with a few other basic things as far as education is concerned. Anyway, Marge Simpson, that is, Marge, I'd forget her maiden name, was quite a woman to be reckoned with until she was bowled over and persuaded to throw her lot in life together with Homer Simpson, who was also in the graduating class of 74 at Springfield High, and who was a basic dweeb. He sort of got through life, coasted through with the C average, didn't plan on going to college, all that stuff. He was just sort of a slider. And she, as I say, she cast her lot in life together with his and became who she is today. I will talk again about another episode of The Simpsons which I saw, which is on censorship. very interesting one. Every now and again you'll find a true gem of an episode mixed in with all the dreck. But that will come at another time. So, that is the, that's the way I feel about the image, the media image of mothering in the 90s. I think she's the best example. All the others, either I don't watch the shows or they're just not enough of a character, of a fully rounded character to even discuss. So for Marge Simpson, and for all the women out there who think of themselves as just sort of a basket full of wasted potential, I salute you.
wisdom. Web pulse wisdom.
That was a song called Housework in Exile by the Holy Sisters of the Gaga Dada, an L.A. band from 1986 or so. Yes, everything I play here is on vinyl, actual LPs. It is 5:51 in the morning, Sunday, March 10th. My name is Sharon Griffiths, and the name of the show is Heresy, where radio speaks with a woman's voice. And before that, Heart and Soul, the dance mix by Tipau. And I thought that was particularly fitting for Mothering Sunday, which, since we're not living in the UK, we don't really know that that is today. But if you have a calendar that shows Canadian and Australian and Irish and English and Scottish and Welsh holidays, you would see that today is their version of Mother's Day, called Mothering Sunday. And if we all remember back that far, Tipau was Mr. Spock's mother. And I kind of missed that. I missed that song. I liked it. Anyway, Housework in Exile by the Holy Sisters has an opening line, "She does the work that disappears." And another line has to do with no means of exchange. Susan B. Anthony, to go from 1986 to about 1875, believed that disenfranchisement, the inability to vote, the inability to speak in a political voice, was the single most important cause of women's inferiority. She blamed society with the capital S. And I would like to read a speech that she gave in Chicago in 1875. The speech is entitled Social Purity, And of course, we know that a lot of what was said in the 19th century sounds today very stilted and very politically incorrect. But we will forgive. We better forgive. I know I do, and you're my audience, so you better forgive some of the shapes and phrases and terms that are used in this speech. People spoke differently 100 years ago or more, and when they wrote, it's left there to be read 100 years hence, and I think that's a miracle in itself. So as they were speaking or writing in this stilted or politically incorrect manner, to them it was the cat's pajamas. So anyway, this address on social purity argues that the prevalence of prostitution, sex crimes, and wife murders proves men's incapacity to cope with social problems, that their basic cause is women's dependence, and that their cure will be women's economic independence and political equality. And now I start to quote. Though women, as a class, are much less addicted to drunkenness and licentiousness than men, it is universally conceded that they are by far the greater sufferers from these evils. Compelled by their position in society to depend on men for subsistence, for food, clothes, shelter, for every chance even to earn a dollar, they have no way of escape from the besotted victims of appetite and passion with whom their lot is cast. They must endure, if not endorse, these twin vices, embodied as they so often are, in the person of father, brother, husband, son, employer. No one can doubt that the sufferings of the sober, virtuous woman, in legal subjugation to the mastership of a drunken, immoral husband and father over herself and children, not only from physical abuse, but from spiritual shame and humiliation, must be such as the man himself cannot possibly comprehend. The roots of the giant evil, intemperance, are not merely moral and social. They extend deep and wide into the financial and political structure of the government. And whenever women or men shall intelligently set themselves about the work of uprooting the liquor traffic, they will find something more than tears and prayers needful to the task. Financial and political power must be combined with moral and social influence, all bound together in one earnest, energetic, persistent force. The prosecutions in our courts for breach of promise, divorce, adultery, bigamy, seduction, rape, the newspaper reports every day of every year of scandals and outrages, of wife murders and paramour shootings, of abortions and infanticides, are perpetual reminders of men's incapacity to cope successfully with this monster evil of society. The statistics of New York show the number of professional prostitutes in that city to be over 20,000. Add to these the thousands and tens of thousands of Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, New Orleans, Chicago, St. Louis, San Francisco, and all our cities, great and small, from ocean to ocean. And what a holocaust of the womanhood of this nation is sacrificed to the insatiate Moloch of lust. And yet more. Those myriads of wretched women, publicly known as prostitutes, constitute but a small portion of the numbers who actually tread the paths of vice and crime. For, as the oft-broken ranks of the vast army of common drunkards are steadily filled by the boasted moderate drinkers, so are the ranks of professional prostitution continually replenished by discouraged, seduced, deserted unfortunates who can no longer hide the terrible secret of their lives. Nor is it womanhood alone that is thus fearfully sacrificed. For every betrayed woman, there is always the betrayer, man. For every abandoned woman, there is always one abandoned man, and oftener many more. It is estimated that there are 50,000 professional prostitutes in London, and Dr. Ryan calculates that there are 400,000 men in that city, directly or indirectly connected with them, and that this vice costs the city an annual expenditure of $40 million. Man's legislative attempts to set back this fearful tide of social corruption have proved even more futile and disastrous than have those for the suppression of intemperance, as witness the Contagious Diseases Act of England and the St. Louis experiment. And yet every effort to establish similar laws are constantly made in our large cities, New York and Washington barely escaping last winter. The work of woman is not to lessen the severity or the certainty of the penalty of the violation of moral law, but to prevent this violation by the removal of the causes which lead to it. These causes are said to be wholly different with the sexes. The acknowledged incentive to this vice on the part of man is his own abnormal passion, while on the part of woman, in the great majority of cases, it is conceded to be destitution, absolute want of the necessities of life. Hence, there is no escape from the conclusion that, while the woman's want of bread induces her to pursue this vice, man's love of the vice itself leads him into it and holds him there. While statistics show no lessening of the passional demands on the part of man, they reveal a most frightful increase of the temptation, the necessities, on the part of woman. In the olden times, when the daughters of the family as well as the wife were occupied with useful and profitable work in the household, getting the meals and washing the dishes three times in every day of every year, doing the baking, the brewing, the washing and the ironing, the whitewashing, the butter and cheese and soap making, the mending, and the making of cloths for the entire family, the carding, spinning, and weaving of the cloth, when everything to eat, to drink, and to wear was manufactured in the home, almost no young women went out to work. But now, when nearly all these handicrafts are turned over to men and to machinery, tens of thousands, nay, millions, of the women of both hemispheres are thrust into the world's outer market of work to earn their own subsistence. Society, ever slow to change its conditions, presents to these millions but few and meager chances. Only the barest necessities, and oftentimes not even those, can be purchased with the proceeds of the most excessive and exhausting labor. Hence the reward of virtue for the homeless, friendless, penniless woman is ever a scanty larder, a pinched, patched, faded wardrobe, a dank basement or rickety garret, with the colder, shabbier scorn and neglect of the more fortunate of her sex. Nightly, as weary and worn from her day's toil, she wends her way through the dark alleys toward her still darker abode, where only cold and hunger await her. She sees on every side and at every turn the gilded hand of vice and crime outstretched, beckoning her to food and clothes and shelter. Hears the whisper in softest accents, "Come with me and I will give you all the comforts, pleasures, and luxuries that love and wealth can bestow." Since the vast multitudes of human beings, women like men, are not born to the courage of conscience of the martyr, can we wonder that so many poor girls fall, that so many accept material ease and comfort at the expense of spiritual purity and peace? Should we not wonder, rather, that so many escape the sad fate? Clearly, then, the first step toward solving this problem is to lift this vast army of poverty-stricken women who now crowd our cities above the temptation, the necessity to sell themselves, in marriage or out, for bread and shelter. To do that, girls, like boys, must be educated to some lucrative employment. Women, like men, must have equal chances to earn a living. If the plea that poverty is the cause of woman's prostitution be not true, perfect equality of chances to earn honest bread will demonstrate the falsehood by removing that pretext and placing her on the same plane with man. Then, if she is found in the ranks of vice and crime, she will be there for the same reason that man is, and from an object of pity, she, like him, will become a fit subject of contempt. From being the party sinned against, she will become an equal sinner, if not the greater of the two. Women, like men, must not only have fair play in the world of work and self-support, but, like men, must be eligible to all the honors and emoluments of society and government. Marriage, to women as to men, must be a luxury, not a necessity, an incident of life, not all of it. and the only possible way to accomplish this great change is to accord to women equal power in the making, shaping, and controlling of the circumstances of life. That equality of rights and privileges is vested in the ballot, the symbol of power in a republic. Hence, our first and most urgent demand, that women shall be protected in the exercise of their inherent personal citizens' rights to a voice in the government, municipal, state, and national. Alexander Hamilton said 100 years ago, "Give to a man the right over my subsistence, and he has power over my whole moral being." No one doubts the truth of this assertion as between man and man, while as between man and woman, not only does almost no one believe it, but the masses of people deny it. And yet, it is the fact of man's possession of this right over woman's subsistence which gives to him the power to dictate to her a moral code vastly higher and purer than the one he chooses for himself. Not less true is it that the fact of woman's dependence on man for her subsistence renders her utterly powerless to extract from him the same high moral code she chooses for herself. Whoever controls work and rate and wages controls morals.